Hello, hello, hello. This is Deborah E. Lake, and this is the anniversary broadcast of All the Way In. It's been a year, and what a year. The lessons I've learned, the people I've met, the things I've talked about, the things I've wondered about. It's been a year, a good year, and a lot of it is because of you. I'm here, I'm unhooked, I'm uncensored, and I'm here to talk about whatever comes up, so you can get to know me. And if you want to call in, you can call in. I have my producer, Trey Wallace, who's going to come in and ask me questions, and I'm going to follow wherever he takes me. Hi, Trey.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi.
Oh, excellent. Hi. Just as Deborah said before, I'm Trey Wallace, and I know you guys aren't used to hearing me out there, but here I am today. So what I want to do is, first off, Deborah, I'd like to ask you, if you wouldn't mind, for all those listeners out there who haven't familiarized themselves with you, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your history and your background?
Oh, sure, yes. First of all, I'm the kind of person who walks in the middle for the most part, between worlds, between races, between a lot of political issues. So I'm not someone who is in a particular box. And one of the things struggling with not being in a box, not being in a place that I claim totally, or an identity that I claim totally, I've learned some skills that I found out were useful to other people to deal with some of the clashes that they were living with and trying to fit into boxes and fit into where they didn't belong totally and struggling with that part of them that doesn't belong. So that's what I do. Now, I come from a family that pushed the boundaries of the day. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. I had a white mother and a black father in upper middle class neighborhood that was racially mixed at that time, which was unusual. And both of my parents, in their own way, pushed their envelopes, pushed the status quo. And I grew up seeing that. So that's what I naturally do now. I naturally look for and see, not necessarily look for, but see. I see where the end of the envelope is, and let's, oh, what's on the other side of that, or how can we, you know, maybe move to another place and see what's there. So I also am an author. I have written one book, and I've got two more books to be published that should be coming out this fall. Activist. I've done a lot of work around civil rights for LGBT, racism, different things like that. And take a couple of knocks here and there, which is no more than anyone else. So that's who I am.
Excellent. First off, I kind of want to go back a little bit to what you were saying before. Now, you said before that you have a white mother and a black father. Now, I know for most people, so how do you identify then? Do you identify yourself because by the one drop rule? For people who aren't familiar with that, the one drop rule is if you have a drop of black blood, they consider you black. Or do you see yourself as something else? Or is that one of those boxes you don't like to be placed into?
Well, it's interesting because for the majority of my life, I've vacillated between claiming my total black heritage and excluding the Irish heritage and actually even hating it, and then the opposite of that, which is craziness in itself. But in the process, I realized that every group of people, if you want to take gender, you can take race, you can take whatever group you want to look at and look at different groups, they all have their good sides and they all have their bad sides. They all have the parts that they're not all that proud of, and they all have parts that are wonderful and should be celebrated. So I consider myself a blended person, but that's not a box that you can check off on a lot of forms. There aren't a lot of forms that have a blended heritage or multi-ethnic. They want to stick you in a box. And sometimes that makes sense because that's how they count people and votes and things like that. But when I have to choose, if biracial is not a choice, I choose African American or black.
Okay. Now, what is it specifically? Because you said you actually used a very strong word. You said hate in regards to your Irish ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
Why specifically? What causes kind of loathing? This feeling of separation from that.
Well, it's part of the family history, especially on my father's side. He was part Irish as well, smaller part, but his great grandfather was Irish and was. A product, I would say, rape, but slave, you know, whichever way you want to put it. That is difficult to deal with. It's difficult to claim that kind of family when the oppression and the violence is part of how you're born or how you're on the planet. And on my mother's side, just dealing with racism in general and having it come from people who look like her, for instance, and dealing with her Irish temper. She had a really typical temper. It made it difficult to embrace the culture. And in the United States, it's doubly because you have the internal family dynamics, but then on the outside you have the world as a child, for instance. The world is telling you have to choose what are you, and they're constantly putting you in a box and labeling you based on how you look, and telling you can't do something based on how you look or how you don't look, or telling you can't be something based on how you look or how you don't look.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. Now you mentioned earlier that that you came from a diverse, you know, community around you for that
mm-hmm.
time, given that, you know, you had a community that and I don't know the exact makeup of that community. But wouldn't that help somewhat with, you know, feeling more comfortable with that? Or by that, I mean people of different ethnicities. Did you ever have issues with them? Because it sounds like you're saying that they were forcing you to go one way or the other. But in a blended community, most people, or at least I would imagine, that, you know, that would make it easier for you to feel a transition, or was it more difficult?
Actually, it was more difficult because the blended neighborhood that I grew up in, which was atypical, but it was still there. It was blended in the sense of people living side by side, sort of like Hyde Park here in Chicago. Hyde Park has they like to tell themselves that they're diverse, but basically what it is different ethnic groups living side by side, but not really interacting that much. And if you go to the neighborhoods in the area, you'll see that people are segregated by race, even today, and they socialize that way. You can find exceptions to the rule, but in general, people, even in places that are where they call themselves blended or multi-ethnic or diverse or politically correct, however they like to label themselves, they might live side by side, but they still clump together based on looking alike. And to me, that's even more difficult because you have the illusion that you're mixing and you're living together and kumbaya, but the reality is you stay over here, and we'll leave each other alone.
So it was more like you were isolated in a group.
Yeah, that's exactly how it is. Yes, yes.
Oh, so I would. So just to correct me if I'm wrong, your community was more like a salad than a melting pot.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I also wanted to know a little bit about. Now, I know you're from Detroit, correct?
Yes.
How do you feel about Detroit then and now? Because I know some people feel that Detroit has taken a turn and has gone through some changes. How do you feel about Detroit now?
When I was a kid growing up in Detroit, I loved it. I loved it. Belle Isle, Boblo, I don't even know if they exist anymore. It was fun. The Detroit River, we could go swimming. And I went back as an adult just recently, maybe the last couple of years ago, and I knew about Detroit and how it has declined, but I hadn't been back. And I hadn't been back to my neighborhood where I grew up in, oh gosh, decades. And I literally cried. It was very sad. It was very sad. It was like going to visit a ghost town of what used to be and the people who got left behind. And, of course, there are pockets in Detroit where you can see some semblance of prosperity. But for the most part, it's very sad to be there. It was for me. It was very sad to go. Living in Chicago reminds me of the way Detroit used to be when I was growing up, and just going back there just made it even more of a loss for me.
Now, I'm curious as well. What, you know, given how you describe Detroit, what galvanized you? What motivated you to leave Detroit in the first place?
Oh, well, my family left.
Oh, okay.
And I had to follow my parents. Well, actually, my mother. She wanted to live in the South. The South was the place to be to her. She talked my father into moving to South Carolina, actually. And that's where I graduated from high school, actually. And that started me on a long road toward more evidence of racism. When I was in South Carolina, that was the first time I was ever called a nigger. I'd never heard that word before. My family moved.
Now, could you lead me to what made you become a minister? Out of all the things in the world to become, what guided you towards the ministry?
Well, first and foremost, I have to say that the guidance and the spirit that I call God, there are different names that people use, but I use God, is what called, that's how I got the call. It came from God, right? Now, as far as answering it, because those are two different things. You get called, and then you answer, or you don't. Sometimes you don't. And I didn't for a while. But the call just would not stay silent. No matter what I did, marriage, children, no matter what I did, that call was still there until I answered it. So there were two things. I was called by God, and then it was so persistent and so strong, and still is, that I wouldn't have any peace until I did answer the call and start living into my call as a minister. So that's what led me to do that. Yeah.
Now, most people in their mind, a minister is forgiving and, you know, has love and compassion in their heart. Given, it seems like there was a lot of turbulence kind of coming as you were growing up. Did you find that difficult to deal with as you went through the ministry, as you studied to become a minister?
Oh, yes. I had several crises of faith and came out on the other end stronger in my faith, but also having a different a deeper faith, and one that out of the turbulence. Let me back up. Part of what happens when we are fighting among ourselves and fighting within ourselves is we're trying to make everything fit like a puzzle, make everyone fit like a puzzle. And the puzzle is ours. It's what makes us feel comfortable. And anything that doesn't make us feel comfortable, that doesn't belong in the puzzle. So we have to get rid of it. And that's where the turbulence comes from, regardless. Now, with me, I was trying to make myself fit in a racial category, make myself fit in an ethnic category, make myself fit in a denomination, for instance. And in that process, I was losing my sense of being called. What was I being called to do? How was I being called? Why was I being called? I was so busy trying to fit and struggling with all of those different issues. When I stopped doing that, then I had to say, okay, now what? So that's when I really started to find out what it means to be a minister to me. And one of the things that it means to be a minister to me is I don't have all the answers. I don't have them all. No one does. I don't know what God wants. If you say you know what God wants, you're putting yourself above God. You can say you know what a two-year-old wants when they jump up and down. You can say you know what your little puppy wants when they lap and act like they want something to drink. But you can't say what you know what God wants. You can't put yourself above God. The best I can do and the best any minister can do, in my opinion, is to help people. We're facilitators. We facilitate the spiritual growth of ourselves and the individual that we encounter. And we facilitate by example, and we facilitate by helping people see where they are in the moment and see where they would like to be. And you do that by being honest with yourself and with one another, but being honest with yourself first. Because if you're not honest about where you are and what you're doing in the moment, you will never get where you think you want to be or where you're supposed to be or where you're being called to go. So, yeah, it's a struggle, but if someone says, I don't struggle, I just do what I'm supposed to do, I'm just a vessel, and the typical words that I hear when people are not taking responsibility for their own actions and they're kind of putting it off out there in the sky somewhere, that tells me that there's no struggle there. If there's no struggle there, there's no growth. They're not growing.
Yes. I'm going to kind of backtrack just for a second.
Okay.
I want to talk to. I kind of want to get the perspective. If you can reach back, you said before the first time that you were called a nigger.
Mm-hmm.
If you could tell me how that made you feel then, what were your thoughts the first time you heard that?
Well, I was afraid because it came with sticks and rocks. They were throwing sticks and rocks at me, and I was afraid and confused because I really didn't know what it was. What the word was. I was very sheltered when I moved down south. I had lived a very sheltered life to the credit of my parents. But I was afraid, I was confused, and I ran home and said, that's what was going on. What is that? Why were they doing that? I couldn't figure out. I couldn't wrap my mind around why other teenagers would look and see me and just start throwing rocks. I was out walking around, just walking in the neighborhood, and that's how it happened. So I was afraid and confused, and I ran like hell.
Now I'd like to talk to you now. Like, how do you see that moment in time for you in the present? That word. What do you associate with that word?
Well, now it's being used in a very different way. people who are not, who don't identify as African American or black, are afraid to use the word, and some people who do identify as African American or black use it to, you know, just all the time. They call each other, and it's an endearment sometimes, they say. That's my nigga kind of thing. For me, I don't like the word. I don't use the word, and I think it's partly because of the way I was introduced to the word and how it's been used historically to hold people back and to justify taking the productivity away from a whole group of people because they weren't entitled to have farms, for instance, and be prosperous. They weren't entitled to have a business and to earn as much money as capitalism would allow them to earn because they were a nigga, right? So I don't like the word, but I understand why the whole culture came out of trying to reclaim the word and trying to give it a new meaning. But to me, that's way too much energy put into a very derogatory word. It really is.
Okay. I'd like to ask you, earlier you said that you like to stay in the middle of the road. Is that correct?
Yeah. Like both middle. Feet in different worlds. Yeah.
Now,
I just naturally do that.
Just to clarify, for most people, and you also describe yourself as an activist. Most people wouldn't say an activist stays in the middle of the road. So how do you reconcile that, being an activist and, like, you know, being a person who likes to go down the middle road?
Okay, that has gotten me into a lot of trouble because when I say that, I'm an activist, but, for instance, if I am working against racism, let's say, right, I'm not going to ignore the fact that there's homophobia there. Because I'm an activist and I'm dealing with racism. So I have my foot in fighting racism, and I have my foot over here fighting against homophobia. And I might be fighting the same people that I'm working with in one group or the other, if that makes sense. I might be with one group fighting racism and then over here fighting the same group that I was just with because they're homophobic. Let's put it that way. So when I'm working against oppression, even within affinity groups, I work against oppression. And part of what we do, and part of what I think undermines the whole movement toward equality, is we tend to ignore the fact that we can be oppressors as well.
Mm-hmm.
We do the one-up oppression thing. Where, well, I'm more oppressed than you are, so it's okay for me to step on your neck while I get mine, kind of thing. And we just kind of ignore that. That I don't do.
Okay. I kind of want to take a step back here, and just ask you a couple of interesting questions here. What's your favorite color?
My favorite color has changed. It used to be purple, but I've done a lot of changing, especially over the last year. And I think it's moving in the direction of a brownish, but not a brown, like a gold brown, like a mixture of gold and brown. I really like that. I'm feeling that now.
That's interesting. Purple is a royal color.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of a regal color, and gold, purple and gold.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Any reason why those are why purple was your favorite, and then the transition to this gold color?
I really couldn't say what the reason is because the change that I have been going through has been so fast that a lot of people who knew me before haven't been able to keep up, and it's kind of hard for me to even keep up with it myself, living it. So I really couldn't tell you. The only thing is right now I'm not feeling purple. I don't necessarily want to, you know, I'm not drawn to that color anymore. I had my...
Can you tell us a little bit about this change?
Oh, yeah. Well, the change, as with all changes, they start coming years back in retrospect. You're always changing. But everything kind of clicked while I was training for the marathon last year, this time last year, actually. When I was doing that, I really was committed to the training process. I was committed to showing up and not really trying to predict how things were going to go or feel bad how things went if they didn't go the way I thought they should go. So my only commitment was to show up and follow the protocol, follow the program to wherever it took me, which was a scary thing for me to do because I was used to being in charge or thinking I was in charge or getting in charge or being in charge or trying to get in charge, right? It was very scary for me to just say, okay, I'm just going to show up and I had to keep throwing ideas out of my head of what I expected to happen. Needless to say, every time I showed up and every training session and the whole process turned me into a new person. And that person doesn't hold back like I used to. I'm not as invested in pleasing other people. And I can see the places where I wasted a lot of time and a lot of energy and just sweat and blood trying to get people to treat me a certain way or look at me a certain way or accept me, who weren't going to ever do it. They weren't. And you're one of the things I tell people now, don't go where you're not invited. If you're not invited, if you're not wanted, if you're not celebrated, leave. It doesn't matter who it is because they're not worth your presence. And that's a hard lesson that I learned. But it's harder to live trying to please because it takes such a toll, and the toll is so small. But over the years, it mounts up until we die early because of it. I believe that. And a lot of times we get sick from all of the tension and all of the repressed feelings that are there. So... one thing I learned was, and that's a big change for me, I don't go where I'm not invited. Someone said to me, I'm doing an event on the 14th, and I got an email from someone that said, so you have to go all the way to Kenosha to have an event. And I said, I don't go. I go where I'm invited. And that was the end of it,
mm-hmm.
You know? So that's a big change. That was a big change for me, and I think in filling these shoes, I realized that there are a lot of people who are still in the life that I was in. They're still, and they don't know it because I didn't. They don't know that they're really not living their own lives. They're living someone else's version of what they think they should do or live, how they should be.
Yes. Actually, I'm going to get back to the 14th, but right now, I'd like to talk to you about the marathon. Now,
okay.
For those of us who, those out there who are listening who have never run a marathon, would you mind taking us, put us in the shoes of Deborah running the marathon? What was that experience like? Spare no detail.
Well, first there's a mental thing. You have to mentally get ready to think. For me, I had to think, get used to thinking about running in a marathon. That was something I had never even thought I would do. It was nowhere in my head, so I had to wrap my head around it. For about 6 months, I got ready just mentally for the training. I used to tell people when I was talking, I'm training for the training because...
Just one thing. Could you go back and tell us, how did you get involved with doing a marathon? And then come back to that.
Okay. Well, I knew about the AIDS marathon every year. I knew about it, but just knew. But my then partner brought some brochures back to where we were living. And I picked it up, and I said, oh, you're thinking about doing a marathon? She said, oh, yeah, I'm thinking about it. And I said, well, if you do it, I'll do it, like that. And that was the end of the conversation. But that opened the door for me to think about it. And she ultimately didn't run the marathon, but I did. I went on and did it. And that's how I just even started thinking about it for myself. She brought a brochure and plopped it on the table at the time. Yeah.
So could you, I didn't mean to cut you off, but could you go back to that place where you were describing the marathon, getting prepared mentally and physically for that?
Oh, okay. Well, like I said, mentally I had to just really wrap my mind around the fact that I was going to do this. And a lot of different things went through my mind. Am I going to kill over dead? I'm too old. I'm going to be the oldest person there. I'm going to be the raggediest person there. I'm going to be the most out of shape. You know, all of the things that you tell yourself that I don't do now, but at that time I did, was, you know, getting in my way. But I, for some reason, I just kept going. And I said, okay, they had information days, and I was, I'll show up for information and just see how I feel after. And I started to, I met some of the people who were there, and some people had run marathons before, and I realized that you don't have to be like some kind of athlete. You know, you can just be an ordinary person and get out there and try. So that's what I'm going to do, and that's what I did. I tried. The training, that got me to the training, which was, a couple of months maybe 3 months. And I knew that I would have to take care of my physical body more than I was at the time, and also follow what they said do. And that required trust. I had to trust what my coach was telling me to do and go through the whole process. And I did. And one thing I didn't do was beat myself up when I didn't accomplish. For instance, the first time I tried to run 17 miles, I didn't do it. I couldn't. I had to. The heat got me, and I had to stop. I didn't like it. I didn't feel good about it, but I didn't beat myself up about it because I knew that would have stopped me, and went back out there and just kept plugging away until it was time to go to Maui. And the funny thing about it was a couple of people that I know that were training, one or two didn't go to the marathon. They didn't make it, but they said, I don't want to be the last person running. I don't want to be the last one in the marathon. I was that last person. I was the very last person. The truck that was coming along, taking the cones that was stopping the traffic, was right behind me. As I went through another mile or a couple of more feet, they would drive up and take the cone, and the race was over. And I was out there. And I did a half marathon. I didn't do a full marathon because it was just too hot and too many hills. And I did what I could do, which is what I promised myself. Follow it through and go as far as I can. And that's all you can in life.
Yeah,
stay committed. Follow it through and do what you can.
I want to ask you now. I want to talk to Deborah Lake, the author.
Okay.
At what point did you decide that you wanted to start writing, and how did you make the choice of what topics that you wanted to address in your books?
Well, when I was in second grade, I was writing little short stories, and I've always, throughout grade school, high school, college, not so much in seminary. You do a lot of writing, but not fiction. Well, maybe it is fiction. But I always wrote short stories and things like that, but I never really did much with it. I let my family read it. So I've always written and enjoyed writing and was kind of pretty good at it. But I got serious when I went to work at the Core Center and realized that there was a huge void in HIV care at the time. Now, not so much. But at the time, there was a huge void. I was a chaplain at the Core Center in Chicago, and this pastoral care, the majority of the people that we took care of were African-American because that was the growing population. But their spiritual needs were not being met as well as they could have been. And I looked for literature, and I looked for literature, and there wasn't a lot out there. There were a lot of little pamphlets, come to my church kind of thing, but not anything for the spiritual, addressing the spiritual concerns. And I don't mean trying to convert. I mean, how do you help someone grapple with the word? Why did God let this happen? Or what do you say to someone when they say, why did God bring AIDS? Why doesn't he take it away? You know, that kind of thing. That's the spiritual care that wasn't being addressed, as far as I could tell, at all. And that's what led me to write my first book. And ultimately, the second edition, which is updated with more information, is built on the first. And what I do is I help people look at spirituality rather than religion. And one good way to do it is to look at the Good Samaritan and look at how, break down his actions in the context of HIV. The Good Samaritan walked up to someone who everyone was stepping over or going around and not, ooh, I'm not going to go there kind of thing, and gave what he had and knew what he could give and gave it and found help and got the person to more help. He knew what he could do and what he couldn't do. And that's a strong basis for addressing the distress that comes when you have any kind of illness that is so it takes your life and it changes it in ways that you cannot imagine. And you never recover from that change. You have to incorporate it into your life and live on. But there's a spiritual part of that that needs to be addressed as well. And that's where my first book came from.
Okay. Now, your second book, was mm-hmm. that born out of the same type of feeling, or was there something else that compelled you?
Well, the second book came out of, it's like the second edition of Your Neighbor Has AIDS, and it elaborates more on the lessons that the Good Samaritan teaches in the context of AIDS care, and has more updated resources in it and more updated HIV information as well. So it's more like building on the first one is building on the second one. It's called I'm forgetting the name of my own book. It hasn't come out yet, so I guess that's okay. But Your Neighbor Has AIDS is already out. But the second book that I've written actually built on the first one.
Excellent. Now, I want to take a moment and take a little bit of time to, because we are coming up on your anniversary special of Lake Enterprises, and from what I understand, the 14th is going to be the launch of your announcement of the Deborah Lake Show, the show now being entitled solely the Deborah Lake Show.
Mm-hmm.
So could you tell us out there, for everyone who doesn't know, the evolution of Lake Enterprise?
Oh, yeah. Lake Enterprise, well, I'll have to back up and say that at first I was in nonprofit, you know, Sankofa Way, and I ran that nonprofit for 6 years. And we voted, the board and I voted to dissolve in our sixth year, because of funding issues, and the funding dries up, more and more people are competing for the same funds, and it's rough out there for nonprofits. And I would imagine it's even worse now because the economy is pretty bad, and worse than it was when we dissolved. That led me to start the for-profit, which is Lake Enterprise. And Lake Enterprise is based on the lessons that I learned from my parents, specifically mostly from my father as far as enterprise goes, and being enterprising, and an entrepreneur, because that's what he was, and a leader, and a person who overcame seeing his uncle and three of his cousins lynched and tortured. And he overcame that and went on to be, he was a young 20-year-old guy, man, and ran for his life from Georgia and overcame that. He overcame that and went on to become one of the most patriotic men I've ever seen. He fought in two wars for the United States and was very, very proud of his country, which is the United States. And he was someone who honored his family, honored himself, and honored everyone around him. So the lessons that I learned from him, and one of the ones that really has taken me a long way, is don't let words, you know, people, just let their words, if they're telling you don't belong or telling you you're not good enough, let them roll off you, like we used to say, like water off a duck's back. And that's the foundation for Lake Enterprise. And from there, we take the lessons that we have. It's a family business. I have four daughters, and two of my daughters are involved in the business right now. We take that and offer lessons, often offer services. We're going to expand this year and offer more services that are ethically based rather than money based. Today in the world, we are focused on how much money can I make. I just got an email from someone just yesterday. He was clearly interested in what we were doing, but he wanted to know, well, what's in it for me, kind of thing. And I told him, what's in it, what you get, I don't know how to answer that, but what you'll get out of it is X, Y, Z. And that's the attitude that we have now. Yeah, I'll do it, but what's in it for me? And when we're facing that kind of mentality, we're at each other's throats, and we can't come together. So what we do through our family business is teach people how to come together and do something that is totally, each person who's involved couldn't even come up with on their own, because each person brings something to the table and gives and creates
synergy.
Something totally different. Pardon me?
A type of synergy?
Yeah. That we're losing that, though.
Mm-hmm.
We are. We're losing that. And it concerns me. Because clearly, these are hard times. We have the Gulf, you know, oil spewing out, and we don't even know how it's going to be stopped. And we don't know what's going to happen, how it's going to affect our water. We just don't know. The economy is awful. People are not working. They don't have money. They don't know when they're going to have money. They're losing their homes, or they don't have a home to lose. Families are breaking up because of economics. So these are hard times. And it's hard to hold on to the fact that, one, I have something to give, and two, it's valuable. And the value is greater than any dollar amount, because it comes from me. And three, I can find other people who can do the same thing, and we can change things and create together. So, yeah.
Sounds great. I want to ask you, now, given that a year has gone by, how do you feel? How do you? Where do you envision Lake Enterprises going from here?
Well, like I said, we're going to expand some of our services. That's the plan. I have a daughter who has jewelry. She creates jewelry. So that's one of the things we're going to offer. The other is massage,
mm-hmm.
body massage. My other daughter is pretty good at that. And so we're going to expand out beyond what we're doing right now and get more into publishing, because one of the things I'd like to do is to offer, and I've just started having conversations, to offer publishing services to people who wouldn't ordinarily get published. We have a small publishing business under Lake Enterprise, and I want to be able to help people get published, because there's a lot of wisdom out there, and we need every single syllable that we can get, every single letter that we can get, beyond the bestsellers and the ones who have the big engines behind them. A lot of times you find the most wisdom where the engines are not. They're not there, and the hype is not. That's where you find the wisdom a lot of times. And that's what I want to tap into and help people get launched the way I was helped when I got launched with my first book. I had help that the book wouldn't have been written, and it certainly wouldn't have been published if I hadn't gotten the help, the kind of help that I'm talking about, that doesn't say, okay, tit for tat, but it's also reciprocal at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yes. I wanted to ask you, this event, for everybody out there, you have an event coming up on the 14th.
Mm-hmm.
Describe, what is that going to be like? What's going to happen there?
Well, the title of what people are going to be doing is talking about the theme or the energy underneath it all. First of all, we're celebrating 1 year of broadcast of All the Way In. When I first started broadcasting with Blog Talk Radio, I had no clue what I was doing, one. And two, was doing it because of a person who gave me some consultation for public relation and promotion said I should do it. That's why I did it. Had no idea it would get the listener base that it has, or have the shows that I have had, or have the guests that I have had over the year, or even last a year. And I certainly didn't expect to have as talented a producer as you are. And that wasn't even in my head. So that's where I've come from with this. And celebrating that whole process is going to be first and foremost. And celebrating, because to the day, July 14th was when I had my first Lake Enterprise business meeting. That's when Lake Enterprise started, this time last year, July 14th, 2009. And I did not know that at the time when we were planning this. It just worked out that way. So we're going to be celebrating 1 year of broadcasting and letting people know what to expect in the second year and what kind of changes we're going to have coming down the pike, some of that. And hopefully we'll have some of the past guests as guests in the show. It'll be videotaped, and we'll put it up. We're going to have it up on our website and on all kinds of stuff. So it's a celebration.
For all the listeners out there, would you mind telling them when and where is this event going to be held?
It's going to be in Kenosha, Wisconsin, at the Rode Center for the Arts. And you can go to my website, DeborahElake.com, and you can get information about exactly where it is. Or drop me an email, and I'll shoot you something out real quick. And it's July 14th. Doors open at 6:30, and it's an historic theater. It's a real theater. It's a gorgeous place. It really is. A lot of history behind it. I think it was first built in the 1800s, I think, maybe. But there's a lot of history behind it, and it's a wonderful, wonderful place. And the Lakeside players were gracious enough to allow us to use the place, the theater, for this event, and I'm very grateful about that. The doors open at 6:30, and it'll go until 9:00.
Okay, and is there any cover charge, or can just anybody show up?
No, just come in. No charge. You'll have an opportunity to contribute what you think is, you know, whatever you have or anything like that. But no, we won't charge at the door. No, you can come as you are and talk about what makes no damn sense to you. What is it that makes you just say, "What in the world is going on? I just don't understand that." That's one of the conversations we're going to have.
On that note, I'd like to, for anybody who's out there listening, we are streaming live, and I'd like to open it up for callers. If you'd like to call in, ask Deborah some questions. The number you guys can call is 1-347-857-3286. Again, 347-857-3286. Feel free to call in. We're going to continue to talk with Deborah Lake. This is Deborah Lake on Deborah Lake. We're going to continue our conversations, but feel free to call in with any questions or inquiries about our upcoming shows or the event on the 14th or just anything in general. Deborah is open for questions. Now, Deborah, I wanted to ask you about your feelings about going forward, because I understand you're in the process of entering an Oprah Winfrey contest right now. If you could tell us a little bit about that as well.
Oh yeah, I have entered. I'm in the contest. And that's another thing that I said, okay, does it make sense to do? And it did. And it's kind of fun. So went in with not a lot of expectations, but I went in to win. You know, I'm not going in saying, oh, I'm not going to win. I'm going about it to win, but following the process at the same time, and not expecting anything in particular, but just following the process. And if people want to vote, they can go to my website, and you'll see a little brown icon off to the left. And I would definitely appreciate your vote. You can look at my little video. You enter a video talking about what kind of show you'd like to do, and it's been fun so far. So yeah.
Excellent. I wanted to ask you before you talked about the difference between religion and faith. If you wouldn't mind, for those of us who, you know, out there don't really understand what, if for those of us who see religion and faith as an intertwined thing, how do you, because you kind of started to differentiate the two, would you mind clarifying that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Religion and what I call spirituality, and then there's faith as well. Religion is what came out of our efforts to differentiate ourselves from one another. That's what religion is. That's all it is. I am this and you are not. And I am this because I have this religion, I have this set of beliefs, and I follow this tradition, and I do this instead of that over my meal. That's what religion is. then there's faith, and that is what keeps you from just totally giving up. You, for instance, we don't know that the sun's going to rise, but we build our life on the fact that the sun will come up the next day. That's faith. That's what that is. You have faith that it does. Then there's spirituality, and that is, that's energy. You can feel a spirit. You can feel the spirit in a person. And that's something that the person is not in control of. The only way you can, you can't control your spirit. The only thing you can do is nurture. You can nurture your spirit, or you can cause damage to your spirit, one or the other. And you do it with the actions, the type of life you live. You can feed your spirit, or you can starve your spirit and have it become something that's perverse. So those are like three different things, and religion is, I like to look at it like a ball. The outside ball is religion, right? And that's what you can see, and that's what everybody identifies with or not, and that's what people are arguing about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I believe this, so that's what God said. And then there's faith under that, and that's what keeps people engaged and keeps them alive and keeps them saying, okay, I'm going to wake up the next day and this is what I'm going to do. And then the core, in the center, is your spirit, your spirituality. Okay, and they're not separated from one another, but they're distinct. And your spirituality informs everything else all the way out. So it's very important to maintain and keep your spirits happy and balanced and growing in the direction that you want it to go, because that affects everything that you see, hear, do, say. It affects it all.
Okay. I want to take a moment and kind of ask you a couple of just little tidbit questions, just to kind of find out a little bit more about you and just things you like. What is your favorite food?
My favorite food is sushi. I love sushi. I love it.
What type of sushi?
Ikura. I love that. That's my favorite. I can eat that every day.
Oh, nice. Any sushi restaurants you would recommend to anybody out there?
No, I can't come off any off the top, but I can tell you in New York, you can get good sushi on just about every other corner, I would think. Yeah, I lived in New York, and you can get good sushi there.
What's your favorite recreational activity?
I get the most joy out of running along Lakeshore Drive. And I know that's very specific, but it's true. It's like there's some kind of energy there or something. I don't know what it is. Or maybe just the process, because that's where I trained for the marathon, just the process of overcoming over and over and over. I get rejuvenated in ways that I can't imagine every time. It's something new. And that's what I love doing. Running along the lake. I was out there a couple of days ago, and it started to rain, and it felt great. Yeah.
What is your least favorite thing to do?
Least favorite thing to do? I hate cooking. I do not like to cook. I like to enjoy my meal and sit down at the table and have a meal. But I don't like cooking at all.
If you had a choice of any other job you could do other than the job you currently have, what would it be?
Ah, that's a hard one. You know, I really like what I'm doing. The only thing I don't like about it is I'm, you know, and the pay is not that great, but
you know, if you had the opportunity to go out there and drive a fire truck or you know, be a rock star.
I think I would love to fly a plane. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I think that would be great. Yeah.
Now we're gonna go the other direction. Could you name an occupation that you would not like to do, that you would just absolutely not want to do?
I wouldn't want to be a trash, pick up trash, you know, truck. No, I wouldn't want to do that.
What's your favorite smell?
Let's see. I love the smell of, and this is going to sound weird, I love the smell of the outside, outdoors, and not just any place, but where there is lush and green, and the air is clean, and you can smell the leaves and plants and flowers blooming. That's one of the things I loved about Hawaii. The air was fragrant with plants and flowers. That's my favorite smell. Smelling the earth growing and doing its thing. One of the things I liked about Massachusetts when I first went there, I lived in Massachusetts for about a year. Long enough to get profiled by the police there. And but the air was so, in Western Mass, was so clear and clean and crisp and smelled wonderful because there was a lot of woods and grass and things around, yeah.
Okay. If you only had one pressing world issue that you could inform people about, what would that be?
Inform them about?
Mm-hmm.
It would be what you do when you raise your children affects the kind of person that they are, and that affects future generations. In other words, I would help parents and schools warehousing children in these schools the way we do now is causing more damage than you can believe. Having parents be away from their children. My daughter has two children, and she struggles because she has to work. And she doesn't struggle as far as economics, but she struggles with the time that she doesn't have for her children because she has to go out and work. That has a toll. That takes a toll on the child. I would inform people about the importance of childhood and innocence and maintaining and protecting that and nurturing, because a lot of times when children are not given the outlet, for instance, take a kid who is music, walking note, you know, he hears music. If he doesn't have that outlet, he's not given that outlet for that energy, it turns in him and it can become something else, in frustration, anger. It's like not being able to do what you're born to do. And that's what I would tell people, inform people about, that it's children from day one need to be protected, one. And they know what's going on, and they need to know that somebody's there who cares about them. And it doesn't have to be man or woman. It doesn't have to be. It has to be someone. The relationship has to be good, and they have to care and nurture. So that's what I would do, because that's where the change comes a lot of times. You can change yourself, but generational change comes when you affect the children and help them see something and be something else.
Now, if there's only one thing that anyone in the world can know about you, what would that be if you could choose that?
It would be that I don't give up. I do not give up. And if only one person, only one thing someone could know, nothing else about me, know that I don't give up.
If you only had, let me rephrase that. Is there a place in the world that you've always wanted to visit that you haven't? And why?
Oh, yeah. I'll say this. There's a place that I would like to visit, but I'm afraid to, because I'm afraid of what I'll feel when I'm there. And that's the place where you can go and in Africa, where they held the slaves to be slaves before they put them on the ship. You can go visit those places.
Mm-hmm.
I went, I have mixed feelings about it. Part of me thinks I need to go, and the other part's telling me, yeah, you might not want to do that. But I feel like I should go. I would do that. I haven't, but I would.
Who has inspired you the most in your life? What famous person, I should say, has inspired you the most, whether it be Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or Olivia Newton-John? has there been anyone who's inspired you that you look to as a role model?
I think I would have to say, and you don't hear much about her, but I think I'd have to say Tina Turner, because of just her whole life and what she overcame to get to where she is now. It would be her. There are others as well, but she would be one. Bayard Rustin is another, because he. A lot of people don't give him credit for the March on Washington. That wouldn't have happened if he hadn't gotten in there and brought the groups that were fighting among themselves and fighting for power and fighting for who said what and who, all of that. If he hadn't gotten them down center, it wouldn't have happened. And a lot of people don't know that. That kind of gift, that's a gift to be able to bring people together who are fighting each other and opposing each other and help them find common ground and move and do something totally different. And that's a gift. So there are a couple of people, and those two stand out first.
Let me ask you, do you have any special talents that no one knows about? Any secret talents?
I don't know that. That no one knows about?
Well, that most people wouldn't know. Maybe you can quack like a duck. or maybe your arm moves, you can twirl it all the way around your head. Something unique that is unique to Deborah Lake.
Well, one thing that I don't know if this is what you're looking for, but When I was growing up as a kid, I favored my left hand when I first started using things, and back then left-handed people were encouraged not to be left-handed. So I fell in that category, and the result is I use both hands. And if someone says make a right here, I might get confused because I don't think right left. I think okay, I do this with this hand and I do this with this hand, right? So I don't know if that falls in the category, but that's something that I don't talk a lot about, and that doesn't come up often in conversation.
Okay. All right. What is for people who know you, who are your friends, how would they describe you?
I think they would describe me as loyal. Sometimes difficult. I think that I would be described. They would describe me as fun. I'm fun to be around and energetic. And sometimes I bounce off the walls. And that can be a little hard to take.
That's a special skill.
Yeah.
That's a special skill right there. Again, I kind of want to go back. Once again, we want to thank all of our listeners out there. We are here speaking with Deborah Lake, and she's talking. This is Deborah Lake on Deborah Lake, giving you guys a little bit of insight as to who she is as a person, what she's about, what her thoughts, her views are, what her perspective is. We also are here talking about her one-year anniversary, which, again, is on the 14th, and it will be held at the Rohde Opera House in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Please check out her website. And you, from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, Deborah, it's come one, come all, correct?
That's correct. Come one, come all, yes.
All right. So we're going to ask a few more questions of Deborah. Again, if you guys, we're about to wrap up, but if anybody wants to make any last-minute call-ins to ask Deborah some questions, we have a few more minutes. The number is 347-857-3286. Again, you guys feel free to call in and ask Deborah a question. Now, Deborah, could you tell us again to come back to the event that's happening on the 14th? I understand you're in the process of promoting this event. How did you settle on Kenosha, Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm.
You're based in Chicago, correct?
Yes.
How did you choose to go out to Wisconsin?
Well, there were several things going. We first looked at Chicago, and Chicago can be a difficult town sometimes. So we broadened out, and actually you found the place, and it's a great place, and parking is perfect, you know. So they were very gracious, and the rest will be history.
Excellent. Anything else? I know you told us that this event is going to have some comedians, some singers, and you're going to be talking about things that don't make sense. But what can we expect as far as atmosphere? What is it going to be like? Or is there going to be an opportunity to talk with you after the event is over? Will people be able to talk to you and just have time to interact and engage?
Yes, and one of the things that is I think challenging is it's going to be a part of it formatted, of course, like anything like that. You have to have logistics and taking care of all of that. But there's also room for, this is like in everything I do, I leave room for the unexpected, and that's where the flow comes. People will be able to talk with me. There'll be hopefully be able to talk with some of my guests locally or that I've had in the past. We'll be able to answer questions, ask questions, or say a few words about what gets under their skin, kind of thing. So it should be a very good, fun evening for everyone. You can bring your kids. It should be good.
Awesome. Do you have any other events coming? I know you have the new book coming out. I know you have the event on the 14th. Is there anything else that we can expect as far as new shows or new events or anything else coming down the pipe?
Nothing that we haven't already covered, but one of the things that I would ask people to look for is there's going to be some changes, and with the radio show, good changes, exciting changes, and just to stay tuned and keep listening and let everybody else know about it as well. Yeah.
All right. I want to ask you just a few more questions, and then I think we're going to wrap it up. Now, if you could name maybe three of your favorite shows that you put on in the past year.
Well, one show that I really enjoyed doing and enjoyed the conversation, and I think we got to some touched on some important issues. Was the interfaith show where we talked about where is the line between terrorism and religious zeal? Where do you cross that line? What does it look like in different communities? And how do you recognize it? And how do you deal with it? We had callers from different parts of the country representing different religious traditions, from Christianity and Judaism, and one person called from, I think, Egypt. He was one of the guests. And we had a very, very exciting, I think, conversation. And that's been one of the more popular shows as far as listeners as well, and for downloads. Another one was the Good Hair show, especially the second one. The second, we did two, and the second one was, both were very good, and they brought some insight that was needed, let's put it that way. And I really enjoyed doing that show because I learned a lot of, I learned a lot about hair and black women and that I didn't know about. And the conversation was intelligent, respectful, and informative, I think. So those were two really good ones. And one other show that I really think was important to have as far as the conversation goes and start the conversation, and actually I think I'm going to follow up on this one in the second year, is male rape, where men get raped, and just having that conversation. We had a guest who was a male rape survivor, and he talked about not having any place to go to talk about it. Where does a man go when he talks about when he needs to talk about being raped? Where does he go to get help? You know, that kind of thing. And what is it like for a man to come to grips with the fact that he was raped? I mean, we think of rape as a male on female, but men get raped as well. So those are three shows that I think that stand out the most. Not the most, but stand out with this question right away.
Well, I think we're, again, if anybody wants to find out more information about the event on the 14th or how to purchase Deborah's books, please visit her website. Right now, I'd like to turn it over to Deborah, and if she could just give us a few parting words, anything that you'd like to share with our audience, that would be great.
Okay. I just would like people to remember that you are who you are because that's who you're supposed to be. If someone is telling you that you don't belong or you're not good enough, don't take it in. Understand that that's not who you are. That's about more about them than you. And live your life to the fullest. And come out on the 14th and help me celebrate. What?
All right. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
Out there.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been a fun time. So please tune in, and we'll have more shows, more fun, more frivolity with the Deborah Lake Show.
Yep.
Take it away, Deborah.
I'm Deborah E. Lake, here to let you know that you can recognize, claim, and live fully in your life. Goodbye, world.
This has been All the Way in Radio. Remember, be all the way in your life. Until next time, get connected at alltheweyin.org. While you're there, check out our resource section. It will help you recognize, claim, and live fully in your life. Become part of All the Way In and have full access to special discounts and programs. Visit alltheweyin.org for details. Take All the Way In Radio wherever you go through iTunes. Questions or comments? Ideas for future shows? Email them to info@alltheweyin.org. All the Way In Radio is a production of Lake Enterprise. Audio production by Marcy Height. Creative consultation, Design House. Music by Andre Morganoff and Gautam.